Hello everyone, I'm Phil Blancato, President and CEO of Latimer Thalmann Asset Management. Welcome to another weekly update where we're going to talk about the coronavirus, the economy, and the state of the markets. As we race through September 16th here, it's hard to believe that a few months back we talked so much about the fall, whether or not there would be a second wave or to a degree a third wave, I guess now, what would happen because of the presidential election, and more importantly, how would the economy continue to open up or get stronger? Squarely, we're in the midst of that. Most recently, the Federal Reserve came out just today and said they're going to be accommodative when it comes to interest rates for a prolonged period of time. The good and bad of that is it means it lets inflation run higher. Higher inflation, in this case, the target being above 2% for a period of time, should get the economy bigger, raise interest rates, raise wages, lower unemployment, and let things grow in general. You see, mild inflation isn't a bad thing. Runaway inflation, which some of us grew up with, is a terrible thing. So the Fed has to organize a path to higher rates, but not too high. That's going to be a tough needle to thread, but certainly that's their goal as of right now. And for that reason, after a day like today, the market continues to grind higher, although we are going to end up, it looks like, flat on the day today, down just a bit. Reality is, with the Federal Reserve being accommodative, buying over $120 billion of bonds every single month, it's keeping interest rates low. Also, loaning money to whatever companies need it, including municipalities and small businesses, is effectively printing money. For that reason, the stock market's held up very well. Add to that, some of the biggest names in the industry continue to do well. You see, large cap tech companies, although in 2000, when we had the tech bubble, weren't making a lot of money, the biggest companies in the S&P 500, which today represent the top five, which represent 25% of the overall S&P 500 index, have actually the highest cash flow of any companies in the index. So it stands to reason that while they are very concentrated in the overall index, it is plausible to a degree that they are driving higher with their strong performance so far year to date. So when we think about where we are today in the equity markets and what's happening as of late, the Federal Reserve has come to the rescue. And in fact, the top five companies are driving the markets higher. And for that reason, we seem to be hanging on here without a heck of a lot of volatility. Certainly, there's some days where it's more volatile than others, but not terribly volatile as of yet. We would expect volatility to increase because of the election and because of the uncertainty around the virus. So let me jump into the virus, then I'll come back with some economic data beyond the headlines. First and foremost, it was just an okay week for the United States. We had high expectations that this week we would see our overall daily case rate go further down. We've come down from the lofty heights of 75,000 to 80,000 a day, and we've gone now squarely below 40,000 on average per day, but not yet down to the 20,000s where we were. Now, maybe some of that is testing, and maybe some of that is people getting the virus in a new way, but certainly it's disappointing that we're not quite there yet. Even our fatality rate, which has again come down from once over 2,500, and we were stuck again up at around 1,200, terrible deaths every single day, we had gotten back down to about 700, but over the past week we're basically flat to actually up a bit. So not as a significant improvement as we would have liked. One interesting point. I mentioned last week that there's a good possibility that Europe will pass the United States on a daily basis for new cases. And in fact, that happened. Just this week, we've had a couple days where we had less cases than Europe. Now, that includes Russia, so be careful in your definition of Europe, Eastern versus Western. But certainly, I would argue that that's an unusual scenario. While we've improved, not significantly, and unfortunately, Europe, which is starting to close some schools and being careful about how they're managing the process, is seeing a rather significant spike. But like the United States, they never had a significant spike in fatalities. Spain, for example, still has days of no cases, and yet they're the one country that has more new cases than anybody else. So they're not seeing a death rate increase, but they are seeing a new case count increase. And that speaks to the narrative of younger people that tend to be less likely to wear a mask in public, tend to be a little bit more open to just doing what they want. Reality is, there was a study done recently. And of 800,000 people that got diagnosed with the disease, of them, 3,222 were of the average age of 28 between 18 and 34. And of those, believe it or not, all but 139 had a pre-existing condition which landed them in the hospital. And most of the times it was morbid obesity, hypertension, or diabetes which caused it. So what we're finding is sort of the same narrative. Many young people get sick, but they don't go to the hospital because they don't get that sick. Those who do get sick and to a degree pass away or have lasting impact on them have a pre-existing condition, and oftentimes it's obesity. What's tragic is that for folks who are overweight, what we're finding is that they have 113% more likely to land in the hospital if they're versus someone who's not obese. 74% more likely to be admitted to the ICU and 48% more likely to die. That's a terrible scenario that we have to now protect not only the elderly, but the folks who are obese. And that's obviously an American problem and something we need to combat and be aware of as we go through the spread of the virus. Good news, though, while our daily case count is not yet down to where we'd like it to be, what we are seeing is significant reduction in pressure on hospitals. As I mentioned in the past, the big concerns were Florida, Texas, Arizona, and California. Not even a real good reason to talk about those states anymore because they're now either back to normal or below normal. For example, Arizona at this point has come down 83% in the number of occupancies in their hospital from the height. So they're down 83% from the height. Countrywide, we're down 45% from the height of people in hospital beds due to COVID. There's only one state in the country, and that's Georgia, that has over 10% of its hospital beds occupied by COVID. Really impressive when we think about where we are to where we have been. On the drug front, we're also seeing rapid improvement. 25 drugs are now in phase 1, 14 in phase 2, 9 in phase 3, 3 are already approved, a limited approval, and 0 as far as full-blown approval. But certainly well on our way, as we know over the next few weeks, that we should see more of an improvement from the overall vaccine front. Add to that, there are other countries that are making headway. Russia, and with their Guatemala Institute, is now vaccinating over 30,000 people in a phase 3 trial. They have a drug that they believe is ready for first-line people, such as doctors and nurses, and already giving it out. And then China, via one of the Chinese-owned pharmaceutical companies called Sinovac, has now partnered with the UAE, United Arab Emirates, to actually give them their vaccine. So now not only is China vaccinating thousands of people in China, frontline people and people who work for Sinovac or Sinopharm, the two companies producing the vaccine, they're now selling it to another country who are actively using it as well. So China has a vaccine that's approved and being used, and it's actually impacting their economy. What we're seeing economically out of China as of right now is stark improvement in their overall economy, what we would expect here if our economy began to open up. Their unemployment rate has edged down to 5.3%, which was a significant improvement. They were expecting to get below 6% this year. And their GDP was up 3.2%, which is a significant rebound from the negative 6.8 where they're at. So China benefiting from as the world turns back on, they're not only getting their population vaccinated, and they're also being able to recover more quickly. We hope that's a path we can soon follow. Whether their vaccine is ready for prime time or not, I guess, is let up for debate. But I find it highly unlikely that they would, in fact, go out and vaccinate thousands of people, if not hundreds of thousands of people, in short order here without having the disease ready to go. And I know there's lots of speculation about China, but certainly there is reasons to believe that they are ahead of us in this vaccine race and benefiting from it right now. The rest of the world still waits with bated breath. I think about Europe and the United States. We're still trying to manage our way through the lockdown. As I mentioned, the U.S. is better, but areas like schools are still problematic. A study that was recently done, and this is part of the reason for our spike, is that when you look at the following universities, University of Iowa, Auburn, Illinois State, East Carolina, University of South Carolina, University of Alabama, and University of Georgia, all of them had a significant spike in early September, the worst of them being places like Iowa, which went from 200 cases early on when the kids walked into school to 1,400 cases. So that's a pretty significant increase. They're now back down to around 300, so a stark improvement as well. And in fact, all of these universities had a significant spike early on in September, and as of late are rapidly improving. The only one that continues to be stubbornly high is Georgia, and they've leveled off here at about 1,000 cases. So it stands to reason that we're getting the hang of this. Students have become aware that they need to do better, and it seems like the schools are putting policies in place to slow down the spread, and hopefully that'll show up in our numbers. But globally, there's still some issues. You know, we still have things to work through. As I mentioned, France has an issue. Germany has an issue. Spain has an issue. Believe it or not, France is back up to nearly 7,500 cases a day from where they were near zero, not back in June. So we're not beating this virus back just yet. We're not creating the herd immunity that we had hoped, and we don't have a vaccine or an antivirus that's quite getting us to where we want to be. Places like India, nearly 70,000 cases per day. Brazil leveling off, believe it or not, anywhere from 50 to 75,000 cases per day. So a really significant number of cases. Brazil did come down a bit. They're actually looking at some days at as low as 30,000. But no doubt still significantly high. However, globally, the last 7 days globally, we did see a minor reduction in new cases of about 3.5%. That's the first time that's happened really in quite a while. We also see a minus tick down in fatalities. So what we're seeing globally is that the new case rate goes high, but the fatality rate continues to stay pretty low. In fact, there's only 60,000 people that are critically ill worldwide. 29 million people have gotten the virus, and as of now, we're looking at a significant improvement. About 900,000 total people passed away, but as of late, we're seeing a marked improvement in the number of people passing away recently as the techniques of using remdesivir, steroids, or different ways to approach the disease is working. One country that's going through a pretty significant spike is Israel. They were down to basically zero new cases back in May, and as they turn their economies back on for all things necessary there, they are now back up to as much as 3,500 cases per day going into the high holidays for Jewish folks. Obviously, this can be problematic. So they're actually shutting the country back down, locking it back down in a disruption to the holidays there. It's unfortunate, but as I mentioned earlier, the disease continues to be stubborn, continues to want to stick around with us. And really, the only way to hold it back from growing is to wear a mask when you're in public. One of the studies that came out specifically about the state of Texas, which I thought was fascinating. If you're in a gathering size of 10 people or more in the state of Texas, specifically Dallas County, there's a 26% chance one person has the virus. If you have 25 people or more, there's a 52% chance one person has the virus. 50 people or more, there's a 78% chance one person has the virus. And 100 people or more, there's a 95% chance that someone has the virus in Dallas County. So as you can tell, it really comes down to knowing who you are, knowing who you're with, knowing where you are, wearing a mask in situations where you're not familiar, especially if you're indoors where you're 19 times more likely to get the disease. So all things considered, we have a very good understanding of where it's spreading, and there's things we can do about it. For example, kind of an interesting story, the University of Arizona is actually using wastewater to be aware of when there's a spike in COVID cases in a dorm. By testing wastewater either daily or every other day, they can see a spike in the messenger RNA or the virus itself in wastewater. I don't know if you know this, but Arizona tests its water regularly because they repurpose a lot of water. And they found that they can actually get to a hot spot by seeing the spike in the virus in excrement and being able to lock down that particular dorm, test every kid, find out who's got the antibodies, quarantine them, and protect the other kids. So, believe it or not, using poop to get ourselves out of this. It's amazing the different things we're trying to come up with, but that's another example of it, and trying to tackle this thing before it gets too far out of control. Good news today out of the University of Pittsburgh. They actually have come up with a prophylactic that's extremely interesting. Believe it or not, they came up with an antibody by looking through, believe it or not, billions of antibodies to find one antibody that is 10 times smaller than a typical antibody. So they call this antibody the AB8. But it turns out the AB8 is a highly effective antibody at completely diffusing the virus as of now in mice and hamsters. It's tiny, so you can actually take it by pill or by aerosol. And even more exciting, it doesn't bind to humans. So in other words, there's no negative side effects. It's extremely exciting when you think about this possibility. Now, it's still early, but something like this that could be distributed globally, and to add to that, have the opportunity to be in a pill form. and be a prophylactic as well as perhaps preventing the disease from actually entering the body is really pretty impressive that we've gotten one that's this far advanced. In the past, we've talked about Eli Lilly, we've talked about Regeneron, both coming up with therapeutics. I'll talk about Eli Lilly in a minute. They've had some advancements. But these folks took 100 billion potential candidates and came up with the one that should solve this. So they're going right now for approval to begin to vaccinate people and begin to test it in phase one trials ASAP. Hopefully this becomes fast-tracked and we have an opportunity to see where this goes. Congratulations to the University of Pittsburgh and the doctors there who came up with this. When you look at the rest of the vaccine front, certainly we've had an improvement on the number of cases globally and to a degree domestically, but we continue to watch carefully about what might happen as far as potential vaccines that are to come. One piece of interesting news, only 62% of Americans, actually I'm the other way around, only 38% of Americans would take a vaccine when made available. 62% are skeptical that the Food and Drug Administration will rush approval for a coronavirus vaccine without making sure it's safe and effective due to pressure from the president. So politics play into this, I guess. Certainly in a recent poll by J.P. Morgan, they found that less Democrats and more Republicans would be interested in taking the vaccine than anyone else. So I guess there's politics that play into this too, unfortunately. I mentioned a few of the names already. Merck has agreed to adhere to scientific principles like the other big manufacturers to make sure the virus is clear and tested. By the way, on that front, I find it hard to believe that any medical company would bring a vaccine to bear without being thoroughly tested, because the damage it could do to millions, if not billions of people. So I'm going to put my faith in medicine here and think that before they bring anything to market, they're certainly going to have it ready to go. I'm not too worried about the side effects, because could you imagine the lawsuits and the potential death of a bad vaccine? Let's see how this plays out, but certainly something to think about. Oxford University has suspended their study because one person got sick. Luckily enough, that person has recovered, and as right now, they've gotten back to vaccinating people in their 50,000-person trial. Moderna has a drug I've mentioned many times in the past, has enrolled 24,000 people. Excuse me, 78% of the 30,000 they expect, and quickly moving along with their phase three trials. We should get results from Moderna in October. We're very excited about that one. Maybe that's the vaccine that gets us out of this, or helps to get us out of this. Pfizer has increased the size of their study from 30,000 to 44,000. Another wonderful sign that theirs has got great potential, and they're willing to test it on bigger swaths of people out there. Novavax is ready to produce 2 billion vials of their vaccine, and their CEO announced the other day that as of right now, they continue to see great results of their current testing environment. So all very good news there from the vaccine front. A new therapeutic from Vaxart announced that the FDA has cleared the investigative drug to begin phase one trials. Let's hope they do the same with the University of Pittsburgh drug in short order here too, because that sounds terribly exciting. Regeneron, a company that I've talked often about with their therapeutic, has entered a new study in the UK to find out how effective their therapeutic could be. The American study should have results here, hopefully in the next week or so. Eli Lilly, another therapeutic I've mentioned in the past, has gave a hint so far of a 500-person study that included high-risk people in nursing homes. This is called the Blaze 1 clinical trial, and what it found that if someone takes their antiviral within the first 3 to 4 days of symptoms, they've got a 72% chance of reducing the risk of infection. That's a marked improvement. Now, this is an intravenous drug, but it's great to see that they have something that could effectively reduce the overall impact of it. Sum this all together, and it really is very good news on the vaccine front. I think we should be excited about where we are and that there is a quite a bit of an improvement overall from where we're going from the vaccines and the likelihood of having something available to us and hopefully relative short order here. It certainly seems that way. All right, let's go back to data now. So the vaccines front continues to be promising, and the antivirus front. Nothing on our hands yet. We keep hoping we're going to have something besides remdesivir or the steroids we've talked about in the past to get us out of this. They're helping, but we're not quite there yet, and we're waiting with bated breath for the next thing that's going to come out to help us. From a data front, how does this all play out? When you think about your portfolios, you certainly want to participate in this market. And in fact, us, when we look at our portfolios, we've gotten a bit more aggressive recently, using up the cash we've had in our portfolios to make our portfolios more invested in the equity market. We've changed our fixed income allocation to own higher quality bonds, moving away from high yield, because it could be as many as 130,000 companies that go out of business in the next 12 months. So when we think about some of these, the data out there, we're trying to have a higher quality portfolio with the idea of let's participate and protect. Because the data continues to be somewhat mixed. As I mentioned earlier, the Federal Reserve is going to be very accommodative. So much so that soon, for every dollar we make, we're going to owe a dollar. That's only happened once in U.S. history, and that's right after World War II. So if we think about the impact of that, it stands to reason that if we get to such high levels of debt, what does that mean for us long term? It probably means higher interest rates. People are going to demand higher rates for buying U.S. bonds because we owe so much debt. In theory, we could become a bit more risky. Higher interest rates means we have to pay more money in interest payments. So it means less discretionary spending. So we're in this kind of balancing act here of adding enough money to the system to get us out of this pandemic. But if we add too much, not only does it spur high inflation, but slow growth for a long period of time. So it really is a tricky balance that we're trying to thread here. And that's why we watch the rest of the data so carefully. Right now, the market certainly has one heck of a rebound in stocks, but it hasn't totally equated to the overall health of the U.S. economy. We're about 75% back to where we were. We're losing about $2 trillion in total growth of the United States. We went from a $19 trillion economy to about a $17 trillion economy. So that's a problem. We need to find a way to get that back. And recent data tells us that we're doing better, but not quite there. Retail sales, as I mentioned earlier, are down a bit month over month. So that's a concern that the consumer, post the CARES Act, the extra money that they got, are not spending as much. That pent-up demand we talked about is not being spent as much right now because folks are going back to just weekly regular unemployment state benefits and the additional aid from the federal government. Unless you're in a state that has the systems in place to be able to pay the extra $300, unless you're in that type of state, you're living on state benefits only, which means less spending. And we're seeing that in the August and July numbers. We do note that there's roughly 6 million jobs open, which leaves about anywhere from 8 to 10 million job people out of the labor force. Why aren't these people being hired by these jobs? Usually it's a skill set mismatch. So we do have jobs available. We just don't have the right people for those that are out there. So we're hiring less in the last few weeks here, and that's not great. We need to see that unemployment rate fall because those folks who are out of the labor market will spend once they get a job again. So when we look at the weekly jobless claims, they continue to be somewhat soft. One of the positive signs that earnings for the second quarter turned out to be, let's just be honest, better than what we expected. And in fact, when we look back at Q2, 84% of the S&P 500 reported better earnings than what they were projected to be. So that's a positive sign. They're still terrible, still down year over year, quarter over quarter, but not as bad as we expected. So for that reason, plus the Federal Reserve being accommodative, plus the economy thinking we're going to have one heck of a third quarter, the stock market has been up. Expectations for the third quarter GDP are as high as 35% in some places. So we went down 35 in the second quarter and put that perhaps as much up as 35 in the third quarter, with the net on the year being something like a negative 3% for the year. Those are annualized number quarter over quarter, by the way. So what that means is we're still going to have a down year, but so far not nearly as down as much as we thought. As I mentioned earlier, inflation has been ticking a bit higher. Year over year, core inflation is back to 1.7. That's in large part due to used cars. The Federal Reserve would like to see that number north of 2% for a sustained period of time, and we're not quite there yet. So plenty of room to go to try and get some mild inflation going in the overall economy, and there's no doubt that we are on the cusp of getting better, but not quite there yet. When we look at the current makeup of the bond market, there's reasons to believe there's some concern. Because bonds are paying very little, we're looking at some of the lowest mortgage rates in our lifetime. But at the same token, we have some concerns about the fact that the Federal Reserve isn't willing to raise interest rates anytime soon, yet rates could grind organically higher. They could go higher only because we as a country are printing so much debt, or the economy begins to improve. If we see the economy improve further from here, interest rates will go higher. And since interest rates are so low, you got to be careful of the type of bonds that you own. I don't mean you need to go out and change your portfolio immediately, but make sure you're not being careful to own too much high yield, or to add to that, have very long maturity bond portfolios. Those could be dangerous in a bond market like this, in spite of the Fed saying they're not raising rates for a while. If they're wrong and the economy continues to strengthen because we get a vaccine or an antivirus, it could be painful to a bond portfolio and beneficial to an equity portfolio. You want a nice balance right now between both. A couple thoughts before we wrap up the call today that I think will be helpful to know. One, as of late, we're spending more than we produce. When you look at consumer spending, it has revived. We're only down about, believe it or not, depending on the area, somewhere between 5 to 25% overall consumer spending, depending on the type of spending you're looking at. However, our industrial production is still down 8.2%. So we're producing less than what we're spending. Add to that, we don't have great demographics. We're about flat on demographics, where the rest of the world is actually, in most cases, worse than us. But certainly, it's not great that when you produce, when you spend more than you produce, usually that means higher inflation. So it's something to think about as we go through the rest of the year here. We do expect volatility to increase from here. In any election year, going back to the 40s, the months before the election, we just generally see a 5 to 10% pickup in volatility. We measure that by something called the VIX, the Volatility Index. And I think it's going to add anywhere from 4 to 8 points trading at 25 today. It's a tradable index. Higher because of the consternations around who's going to win the election. You know, we don't pick sides here. We need to make people money based on what happens. But certainly there's a lot of passion out there right now. And that would mean some volatility, especially if we get a contested election. In environments like this, when the economy at best is just kind of hanging in there, and you're facing things with what happens with the pandemic, what are the results of it, what happens with the election, what's the results of it, it definitely makes people want to invest with their politics or their thoughts on the pandemic. Best advice I can give you is stay clear of that. No one does well by using their emotions when they're managing a portfolio. It simply doesn't work. So for that reason, make sure you're, if you're managing your own money, steer clear of letting those emotions impact your overall portfolio. Remember, many people could have gone to cash back in February or March. There were talks about how this was going to be just like the Great Depression, and that wasn't the case. Remember, we thought Q2 earnings were going to be down as much as 30 to 70% in some cases, and they just weren't down that much. 80% of the companies in the S&P beat expectations, so things were turned out to be much better than we thought. The tech sectors led the way, and they should. They're the ones earning the most money. Now, they're not cheap today. Heck, you could have gone out and saw that Snowflake, a new cloud computing company, is up over 100% on day one. So there is still lots of euphoria in the market, and generally is in the tech sector because this work-from-home environment bodes very well for them, and they're making money because of it. But I think at a time like this, you want to stay diversified. Have a mix of corporate bonds, muni bonds, and government bonds. Have a different types of equities in your portfolio because you never know who's going to win next year. Over the last 10 years, there's been times when small caps won, high yield bond won, emerging markets, or large caps. So I don't think you want to get too caught up in being concentrated in just growth stocks. That can be dangerous for a portfolio, especially when they're not cheap. When we think about some of the things to look forward to, there is one piece of news which I think is really exciting. Business applications are up 14% for the year. That means people have decided 14% increase in overall applications. They've decided to create new companies at a time like this. I think that's exciting because there's been so much worry about whether or not, in fact, we would be able to get out of this. Would we create new industries? Would we grow? And when you see something like that, it tells us squarely that, yes, you can grow your way out of this by creating new businesses. It is this kind of rolling over of the 147,000 businesses that may go out of business and new businesses to begin. So I think that's an exciting piece of news to look forward to in the new year. Add to that, home sales are up over 25%. That millennial generation that gets a lot of grief from the rest of us because they're a little bit different than us, and that's okay. They're just a little different. They may work a little differently and want to live a little differently. Well, guess what? They're starting to buy homes. New York City may have 30,000 vacant apartments by the end of September. New York is not the city I grew up in. It's struggling right now, mightily. Restaurants are still closed. There's not a lot of revenue being made. The traffic is back, but nowhere near what it once was. People are moving out. You know, New York was hit pretty hard. You take New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut out of the death rate for COVID, and the death rate for the country is nowhere near what it would look like. It's a significantly lower number. New Jersey has 1/4 of the new cases of California, and yet it has more deaths. And that's played into the narrative around what millennials want. So what we're seeing is folks have left the city and they're going to buy homes. New home construction is very important to the economy. People building the home, people buying the home, banks lending the money out, the materials needed for it are a sign of growth. And that's a really exciting component of what's happened as of late. No doubt that we're seeing parts of the economy actually do well. So I guess I'd wrap it up with a couple things. Yes, the stock market is not inexpensive, but you want to participate in this market. You just don't want to be overweight equities. I think you want to own higher quality bonds and make sure your portfolio is weathered for those companies that might go out of business. know that we're making progress on the vaccine front, but it's lumpy. As I mentioned, retail sales weren't great. They were just okay. Unemployment's still too high. So we're not nearly where we want to be just yet. Heck, the U.S. debt is closing out on all-time highs since World War II. To get that back under control, we're either going to have to raise taxes, cut spending significantly, or generate higher inflation to grow so that and maintain this, the levels of our debt where we're at. So there's a lot that we have to do in the new year and the years to come to get us out of this situation. It's not a golden lever, that's for sure. And when I look at whether it's the stock market that trades on a 45% premium to its 10-year averages, that tells me that you want to be selective in what you own and make sure you're not just chasing the snowflakes of the world, because what goes up eventually does come down. Some concluding points for you that I think will help you in managing the virus. I read a very interesting piece about the flu versus COVID. So just a couple quick points. How can you differentiate between the illness of tracking your fever? Meaning if you get a fever, how do you know if it's COVID or just the flu? Well, when you get a fever from COVID, it comes on significantly stronger. So it's about the same temperature rating, but it feels a heck of a lot worse. It comes on much faster. Does the speed of the onset vary between COVID and the flu? The coronavirus actually symptoms come on suddenly around the fifth or seventh day after infection, 99% within that window. So if you get COVID, it's going to come on all of a sudden, unlike the flu, which builds over time. If you're staying at home to monitor your symptoms, what are the signs that might point to COVID? The most telltale sign is that your shortness of breath, a pneumonia-like symptom, or a continued fever. That's something to look out for. Sneezing and a stuffy nose are often associated with the cold. Can nasal congestion be a sign of COVID? Not likely. This is much more about a wet cough with phlegm involved, so that's usually not a symptom of COVID. Then, how important is it that I get a flu shot? Very important. If you get sick from the flu, the vaccine can lessen the duration and severity of the illness, and you want to keep your body as strong as possible to fight COVID off. So getting sick from something else can make your body weaker, which can inevitably help you to get COVID. So the stronger you are, the better you are. Will this year's flu shot help boost immunity to COVID? There's no evidence of that, but vaccines strengthen the body, so anecdotally it should help you fight it off. Will getting the flu shot make it easier to tell the difference between the flu and COVID? To a degree. If you get sick after you've had the flu shot, it's more than likely you've got COVID, because the flu shot should help you fight off most flu symptoms. So, you know, eliminating some of the things that could get you sick is a sum total there. And then finally, does having the flu shot make you more vulnerable to COVID? Can you get them at the same time? Having a severe case of the flu could make you more vulnerable to another illness. That's because the body weakens. So just some points for you to think about as we head on into the fall and we go indoors and we got to protect ourselves. Remember, wear a mask indoors because you're 19 times more likely to get it indoors versus outdoors. If you know the environment you're in, you're less likely to get it. You know, if you have a pre-existing condition like obesity, heart disease, lung disease, and the other 10 items that can affect you, be extremely cautious. If you're over the age of 55, specifically 65, 70, and 75, be even more cautious. That's the advice I can give you from all the research I've done. While I'm not a doctor, by studying all this, it seems if we target those who are most susceptible, and we know that drugs like the Gilead remdesivir drug, the steroids that we're beginning to use, the other prophylactics that are coming to market, there's a good chance we can keep the pressure off the hospital system and keep all of us healthy. And that allows us to open up the economy, more importantly, and eliminate folks dying from this terrible disease. Thank you, everyone. Have a safe and healthy week, and look forward to speaking with you next week. Take care.